Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 5.
Len, just finish off what happened to Betty, because I understand you met her some years later.
Yes, I completed my training in the States and went back home and finished my flying career, and the years passed by, and it became 50 years on, and we thought we should have a 50th reunion to go back to the States to visit the stations where we'd trained. And a few classes behind me that went across to the States was a chap called Vic Hughes. And apparently Betty had met him in a similar circumstance to me, a guest at his home. And in fact, he had, because he was single, he had accepted her hospitality, and they eventually they got married. And then Vic stayed over there as an instructor, and I had a very happy life with Betty, because when her father died, she became a millionaireess, and I think she had her own plane. And Vic was became a senior pilot with Delta Airlines and so on, and lived in a beautiful house near Atlanta in Georgia. Anyway, we had this reunion in Lancaster Gate Hotel, planning for this 91 visit to there were a group of the we were all Arnold Scheme people, so we had this Arnold Scheme group going over there, and I was sitting down at, well, in fact, I was sitting down at one table with my wife, and I went across to the bar to get some drinks, and as I was walking across the room, a little lady put her hand up and said to me, "Are you Len Trevelyan?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'm Betty Litford." Oh, I said, I nearly dropped through the floor, but I said, "How wonderful to see you, Betty. How are you keeping? What are you doing over here?" She said, "Well, I'm over here with Vic. Where Vic and I are going to join the reunion tour and go to the various stations." And I was only then that I realised that Vic Hughes, who had been a class 42, about 8, 42, 8, two or three classes after me, had stayed over there and married Betty. But he was a chap from Norfolk, I think. He came from one of the resorts in Norfolk, but he'd stayed over there and married Betty. And anyway, I got out of that without any loss of face or any disharmony. And I must admit that over the years, Betty has written to me regularly every Christmas and every occasion, and even to the present day, although she's not in very good health, she still writes me Christmas cards. And I know when I did go over on the reunion, in 91, and Vic and Betty picked me up and took from the aerodrome and took me to their home where they had a party, and Betty took me up because Vic had an English type pub bar in the basement of his lovely home with all the pull handles and pub handles and all the paraphernalia from British pubs in his own private bar. She took me up into the sitting room and opened a scrapbook, and there was pictures of Betty and I, and she'd taken photographs or had photographs taken of every incident that she could record. And so Vic must have known her attachment to me in those days. He never raised a word of discontent about it. Of course, there was no reason to, because I'd behaved honourably to Betty, other than let her down when it came to the marriage stakes. Oh, well, that was an episode which, fortunately, I'd told my wife about. And so Eve knew the circumstances right from the very beginning. Even when I was over there, I told her about this. So I realised that stories like that could come back and create havoc if they weren't spoken about at the time. Now, that brings me back to where I transferred from Betty's domain in and Dothan, no, in Macon in Georgia, to go to Dothan in Alabama, which was where we were flying 86A Stearman's, Harvard's, and from where we eventually graduated.
How did you find the Harvard to fly?
Well, every aircraft that I've ever got into, I've been heard stories about its liability to swing on takeoff, but I've never met any of those experiences. I've found each aircraft, although it's some of them, like the Blenheim I eventually flew, were supposed to be Widowmakers. I've enjoyed flying all of them and treated them all with pleasure at flying a new type of aircraft. Anyway, the Harvard was really a really good aircraft. You know, you could have many countries, I think, used them as fighter aircraft. There was one experience, though, on I must tell you about, and that was we had night flying. We had in stacks. We were sent out to in stacks at the four corners at various heights. So they had 8 or 10 or 12 aircraft in the air at a time. 1, 2, 3, 4 on the four corners stacked, and we were called in independently to go in and land. And I was in one stack, and all of a sudden my engines cut out. And I thought, God, at night time, I thought, well, what am I going to do? I thought, well, instinct tells me that if I've got a crash, I'll try and find an orange grove or something like that where I can go between a row of trees and get the wings torn off between the orange groves, you know. And I thought, all this was going through my mind, how I could survive. And then I realized I hadn't switched petrol tanks. I hadn't switched from main to reserve tanks. I was going down, gliding down towards the ground when I switched the petrol over, and the engine picked up just as if I'd, you know, they never stopped. And I climbed back again, went into the altitude I was due to fly, and circled round, and took my turn and went into land, and no one said a word, no one had queried it, no one had seen the what had happened. Fortunately, it was night time, and with there were no astute observers of the what had happened to the other aircraft. Anyway, I got in and landed, and until this day, I've never had another soul commented on this incident. And, I can tell you, it's pretty scary when it did happen. But I suppose it is all part of good training when a thing like that happens to you and you get out of it. Because I did consider, you know, ways of what I could do, because we did have parachutes, and we could have landed in other places, I suppose. But when you're gliding down towards the ground, you just think, well, where can I pick a spot to crash? Anyway, that was one incident flying the Harvard. But I got through the course and by the June of 42, I'd completed. And when I was graduated, I was granted a commission with my wings, American wings. I was granted a commission at the same time. And and it wasn't until we got back to Canada, to Moncton, I think it was again, in Canada, where I picked up my English wings. And and we were in the mess there as an officer. I remember Jimmy Coulson, who eventually became Air Commodore in the Provo Corps of the RAF. He was waiting at table, and because he had been a copper in Wimbledon or somewhere, he knew me, and he made a great fuss and kowtowed to me at the table, and we had great fun in my position as a new officer in the mess at Moncton. And Jimmy Coulson was one of the guests that I'd invited to my 91 reunion, but he couldn't come. And we had a... he did come. Jimmy Coulson came to my reunion as an Air Commodore, I think he was, one of the higher ranks of the Prevost Corps. So...
Did he fly?
Oh, yes, he flew, and he was in the Prevost Corps, which was his career after the Air... You know, he didn't come back into the police force. He stayed in the Air Force, and from his flying career, because of his police training, he went into the Prevost Corps and became a troubleshooter all over the world. He used to fly to wherever there was any RAF problems with discipline or whatever. And Jimmy was in the Prevost. The next time I saw him was back in the 1970s, I think it was, before, when I was working for the security service. I had to go down to the Farnborough Air Show to see what other nationals were there, gleaming information. And Ron Galatly, who had been on my squadron in North Africa, 13 Squadron, he was there as chief test pilot to the on the helicopters. And he and Jim were great friends, and I met them both there. And Ron Galatly could do things with helicopters, you know, loop the loop, fly upside down, and all sorts of things. And I don't know what happened to Ron, what finally happened to him. I'd like to have heard that. Anyway, we're getting off track, but we're at Moncton, aren't we? We're at Moncton, and I'm qualified and got my American wings, my American silver wings, which I've still got, and my RAF wings. And we go back, I think, Dominion Monarch, I think, was the name of the boat we came back home on. And the first place we went to, that I can remember, was Bournemouth. And at Bournemouth, I can't remember why or how, but we went through all the... we went to the dentist. We had to have our teeth checked, and we were taught etiquette as officers, you know, what we were expected to do, hence lectures and all sorts of things. And I went to the Gieves shop in Bournemouth, in the square there, and ordered new uniform. Oh, and it was, I should have gone home to see my wife, because I'd been all that time without seeing her, but with the prospects of going home as a scruffier in old RAF uniform, or going home in officer's uniform, I postponed my visit for a couple of weeks until I got my officer's uniform. So when I eventually did go home to see Eve, it was belated, and she was upset about this. And she said, "You've been in the country all this time and you haven't seen me." I said, "Well, I wanted to come like this." And then, so, anyway, I did eventually get fitted out and sorted out as an officer at Bournemouth. And then I was posted, I forget where I was posted to then. I think I was given home leave came home and saw Eve, and then I think I went up to, up to Acaster Malbis in Yorkshire, I think that is, and did a conversion from single engine Harvards onto Oxfords. I think we first converted onto an Oxford. Airspeed Oxford, which is a twin-engine aircraft, and from then on to Blenheims, and I flew a Blenheim Mark 1, and eventually on to a Blenheim Mark 4, but this was, what was the other aerodrome that we went to, I forget, on Humberside in Yorkshire, Leconfield, I went to Leconfield and completed my OTU, Officers Training Unit, Operational Training Unit, OTU at Leconfield, where I crewed up with my lifelong friends, Freddie Chapman and Leonard Rivett, who stayed with me right the way through until we completed our second tour. Anyway, we did odd jobs when we were there for experience. I know one of my colleagues, Ron Thane, he had been a policeman down at Hastings, I think, or Dover at Hastings on the south coast. He was asked to do demonstration smoke dropping in Salisbury Plains in a Blenheim, and there was a mishap inside the plane when they released the smoke bomb. It didn't discharge and filled the inside of the aircraft with smoke, and Ron crashed and was killed. Those sort of things happened, and I know what part of the operational training we were flying in bad conditions, and another chap, he crashed just in the Scottish hills off Ayrshire, the Black Hills I think it's called, David Chalmers, and he, whether he'd been doing anything he shouldn't do or not, because he came from his father was a doctor on the island of Islay, and whether he'd been doing something he shouldn't do, but anyway, he crashed and killed, and that was when I first started finding casualties amongst my personal friends. Eventually, we came down south, and
could you just describe Rivett and Chapman?
Oh yes, by all means. Rivett, he was a very conscientious lad who was a member of the Toc H, and used to worship whenever he could. He was very religious and conscientious, and a young chap, and he's just 21 or something like that. And Freddie Chapman was my gunner. He was a little short chap. He'd been in the post office, I think. He came from Birmingham. He was a Birmingham lad. And might as well hear mention it that when we left the Air Force, Freddie Chapman became Lord Mayor of Birmingham, for a Lord Mayor and Deputy Lord Mayor and Chairman of the airport, Birmingham Airport Committee, Chairman of the airport. Leonard Rivett, when he came back out of the Air Force, he went to Durham University and became a Doctor of Divinity and became a minister in Yorkshire and went round the various parishes in Yorkshire, and is at this day, although he's retired from the ministry, he's padre to the Elvington Air Museum in Yorkshire, Leonard Rivett. He's still alive. Unfortunately, Freddie Chapman has died, but we've had some reunions, very good reunions together. So, yes, they were conscientious, both conscientious, it's pretty Freddie Chapman was such a little chap, because I'll tell you later on how his size had some bearing on one of our trips. We eventually, one of our postings, we didn't know what it was entailed, but we were posted to take reforce aircraft out to North Africa. And prior to this, I had to go to Filton Aerodrome and pick up a brand new Mark V Blenheim. And we were to fly this around Cape Finisterre, Cape St. Vincent, and round to Bleeder in North Africa. But to do this, we had the aircraft was fitted a great overload tank. It was about a meter square, which it had to be pumped into the wings into the wing tanks as we flew out. Anyway, that's jumping the story. We got this new aircraft from Filton, and it wasn't anywhere near as lively as the Mark IV or the Mark I Blenheim that I'd previously been flying on. It was a wallowing, heavy sort of aircraft, and I didn't like it a bit compared with the Mark IV, but anyway, we were due to take it out to North Africa. We had our briefing, and we were leaving from Portreath in Cornwall. And there were, I think, 12 of us assembled there, 12 people due to take Reforce aircraft out there. And I know one of them was Alistair Campbell, a friend of mine from Ayrshire, who joined the squadron like me. We due to take off in you know, intervals, and I, first time I took off, I climbed over the Scilly Isles towards Cape Finisterre, and when I got to the height that I was due to fly, the propeller wouldn't feather. It wouldn't change from find a course pitch. And I tried, experimented, dived, did all sorts of things, but realizing that I wasn't going to make it, I had to go back and re-land. But to do this, I had to go over the Bristol Channel and discharge all the excess wing from my wing tanks, all the excess petrol from my wing tanks. And this was a terrible feeling, because up till then I had a little old car to go home and say, and if I could have scrounged a pint of petrol from anyone, it would have been a joy. It would enable me to get my little Austin 7 Ruby saloon back home to London. But to have to dump all this petrol in the Bristol Channel was really a terrible thing to have to do. But anyway, I had to do it because I couldn't land with all that amount of petrol, re-land at Portreath. Anyway, I did re-land, and it didn't take very long for them to reflix the, I think they lubricated the glands that were in this that hadn't been lubricated properly, and that's made them seize up in the variable pitch propeller. So this was lubricated, and we were then allowed to take off again. But we were told by flying control that we couldn't go because the wind change was from the south, and we hadn't got sufficient range to get down to Gibraltar, which was to have been our first landing point. And this disappointed us, and we had to make new plans, but the flying control said, well, there's only one way that you could have done it, and that is by flying direct straight across the Bay of Biscay and over Spain and Portugal, straight down to Gibraltar in a straight line that way. He said, you might have just about made it. So I said to my two lads, Freddie and Glenn, I said, well, how about it? Shall we risk it? Shall we try it? Oh, yes, let's do it. So we got the weather report. There was a cloud layer at 8,000 feet and a cloud layer at 15,000 feet. A light cloud layer at 8,000 and a heavier cloud layer at 15,000. So we decided to fly between these two cloud layers. Now, when we were flying across the Bay of Biscay, I saw a JU-88 coming from the port side, out from the French coast, as it were. And it was making for, I think, the aircraft ahead of me, because I could just see a slight dot of an aircraft ahead of me that went from this gap in between the clouds down into the lower 8,000 level. But I went up into the 15,000 heavier cloud and carried straight on, and this JU-88 obviously didn't come for me or didn't spot where I was going. And so when I got to the north coast of Spain, the cloud lifted, it was 10 tenths, beautiful sunshine. Anyway, we pushed on, and I suppose we must have taken a route because we had no maps. We weren't allowed to have maps of neutral territory or anything like that in the aircraft. We pushed on and probably followed the route which divides the boundary between Spain and Portugal. And we'd got no idea what progress we were making. We had got no bearings or anything like that. And this is where Freddie Chapman comes into the story again. I said to Freddie on the intercom, I said, Freddie, will you see if you can get a bearing on a civilian station like Oporto And if we can take a quarter of an hour bearing on it, of difference, quarter of an hour, 20 minutes bearing, we can see what progress we're making, what airspeed we're making. And he said, okay, Governor. And I waited for about quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and still no joy from Freddie. I said, Freddie, how are you getting on with that radio station? He said, well, Governor, he said, Trev, he said, I can't change the crystals in the radio set. Apparently in the turret, the two they got a pair of 0.5 machine guns. The radio sets are set beyond the turret, on the far side of the turret, and Freddie, with his little short arms, couldn't reach across to change the crystals. Apparently the civilian frequency needs a different crystal in the set. I said, why is that? He said, well, I've got so much clothing on. He said, I've got my best blues on underneath my ordinary ones. He said, and I can't reach off. I said, well, for Christ's sake, Freddie, get out of the turret and get undressed and get back in and get the crystals put in. Well, another 20 minutes went by and I asked him, and he said, I can't get out of the turret. He said, I'm stuck with all my uniform on. So I had to, we had to scrap that thought of getting a bearing from Oporto. So I said to Len Rivett, I said, Len, as far as my geography is concerned, I can remember that the Guadalquivir River is a very broad, many estuaried river as it goes into the Atlantic in the south of Spain. I said, surely we can map read that when we come to it, and when we get to that, we'll just turn to the starboard and go out to sea and crawl round the coast, crawl round until we get to Gib. So he said, all right, well, we kept our eyes open, and we quite easily spotted the Guadalquivir River. But by that time, I was getting very worried, because we were almost down to nothing in the on the gauge of the petrol tanks. So I said to Len, I said, is there anything left in our overload tank? And he pushed it. He said, no. He said, we've transferred every last gallon out of that into the tanks. He said, all we've got is what we've got showing on the meters. So I eased back, took very easy, dropped my engine revs and went in. And the procedure at landing the Gibraltar, in those days it was the old Gibraltar runway, a very short runway, with, although they were lengthening it at the time into the Algeciras Bay, they built an extension which they were filling up with rubble. Anyway, we flew in towards the face of the rock, giving the recognition signal of the day. We got no response, and I sort of not exactly lost my temper, but I said, are you sure you got the right letter of the day? And he assured me that he had, that we were doing everything right. So I said, right, well, we're going into land, come what may. So I dropped my wheels down. I would turn to starboard, dropped my wheels down, made my last approach before turning in. And I thought, well, I've got to do it right. I've got absolutely no petrol in the tank. I've got to be at height, if necessary, and glide in. So I did a beautiful precautionary landing, and touched down at the very first few yards of the runway, and as I was doing so, they were firing rockets at me and Veery guns and everything else. I was really breaking all the rules. But as I touched down and ran forward, so both engines cut out, and the Gary, or the truck from flying control, dashed over to me and told me to turn off and report to flying control. I'd be disciplined and all that sort of thing. And I said, I'm sorry, mate, I've got no petrol. Our engines have cut, bone dry. I can't taxi off the runway. And he arranged to have me towed off. But the reason was, the aircraft in front of me, a Wellington, had overrun the existing runway and had landed nose up in the extension of the runway. It had overrun the the existing runway and standing on its nose in the, and everyone was panicking trying to save that or to get the crew out of that. So that's why they were trying to keep me from landing there at that particular time.